Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Hey there, San Diego. It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. This week, San Diego City Council voted to increase the minimum wage to $25 an hour for many tourism workers in the city.
Corporate America has proven itself unwilling to share fairly with the workers who make their extravagant wealth possible. So, if forced to choose a winner, you're damn right I'm choosing the workers.
We take a look at what the wage hike for hospitality workers means for the greater conversation around San Diego's high cost of living. Then, local news coverage is shrinking, but one San Diego news site is looking to turn that around and double down on local coverage. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. San Diego City Council voted this week to increase the minimum wage to $25 an hour for most hospitality workers. That's a sizable increase from the current minimum wage right now, which is set at $17.25. Joining us to break it all down is KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen, along with Scott Lewis. He is editor-in-chief and CEO with The Voice of San Diego. I want to welcome you both to Roundtable. Andrew, tell us more about the details here. Who's included in this wage increase?
Well, there are three categories of businesses that are covered by the ordinance, and those are hotels, event centers, and amusement parks, all sort of loosely within this framework of hospitality workers. And so hotels have to have at least 150 rooms. So smaller hotels got a special carve out. Event centers are named specifically in the ordinance as Petco Park, Pechanga Arena, the San Diego Convention Center, and the Civic Theater. And then amusement parks have to be at least 75 acres. So the only site that actually meets that criteria is SeaWorld San Diego. So all employees of these businesses covered by the ordinance are covered by these wage increases. So that includes janitors, room cleaners, front desk receptionists at a hotel, parking attendants. If a hotel has a restaurant, then the servers, the cooks, the dishwashers are all included within that. Employees also of businesses that lease a space from a covered employer. So, a business within a hotel is also covered. There was an owner of a jet ski rental company that operates out of a hotel in Mission Bay that showed up to the ordinance and said, or the city council meeting and said, you know, she felt it was unfair that she's covered while her competitors who aren't tied to hotels are not. And then the ordinance also includes contracted services. So a hotel couldn't get around this by just like hiring a janitorial services company and then arguing that these janitors are not direct employees. They have to be covered by this ordinance as contracted services within that hotel.
So a lot of, you know, technical details there about who qualifies here. But Scott, these increases are also kind of, you know, coming in over time, right? Tell us about, you know, how they're being phased in.
Well, the last week leading up to the ordinance as it was drafted was a pretty, intense frenzy of negotiations. The last couple weeks, really, the zoo was removed. They had been included in a previous draft. The San Diego State's arena and stadium were eventually removed. And then there was a lot of wonder about if the hotels, the large hotels in SeaWorld and the Padres at Petco would have to pay, you know, the increase right away. So, you know, if you're paying a minimum wage at $17.25, to go to $25 an hour would be a really big jump. And so they spent the last few days negotiating phase-ins. And so the SeaWorld and the large hotels made a deal for a phase-in at $1.50 per year up until it gets to 25, and then it would increase by inflation. And the Padres at Petco Park, they already pay the living wage, which entities that either work with the city or lease city facilities have to pay. And so they were already at $21. And so they're going to go a little more slowly up to 25 and then again continue at that inflation. So there was a big frenzy of deal making, and in exchange, those entities all agreed not to fund a referendum to try to, you know, overturn the ordinance.
And the phase-in terminates, or it reaches the $25 wage in 2030. So there was some disagreement between, is that a 4-year phase-in because it's going to take effect in July of next year, or is it a 5-year phase-in because, you know, we've got almost a year until July. Regardless, you know, that $25 an hour wage won't actually apply until July 1st, 2030.
Got it. So, you know, this vote by the city council, the larger picture here, it seems to tap into these issues around San Diego's cost of living. And I want to dig into that a bit. Andrew, just to put it into perspective here, how much do you need to make to live in San Diego today?
Well, it's a sort of a tricky question because, you know, people live in different neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods are more expensive than others. But, you know, several people in the meeting referenced the MIT living wage calculator, and that just tries to kind of come up with an average cost of living for a city or a metro area, and then calculates what someone needs to earn if they're working full time to be fully self-sufficient, you know, be able to cover all of their basic living expenses. And that tool says that a single person needs to earn $30.71 per hour to earn a living wage in San Diego County. Obviously, that's higher if you have kids or other people in your household who can't work, maybe an elder grandparent or something like that. So, you know, even at the $25 an hour wage, that again won't take full effect until 2030. You know, there's still a pretty big delta between what you know, this academic tool says would be a living wage and what this living wage ordinance will ultimately require. And then for comparison purposes, you know, you mentioned the city's minimum wage is currently $17.25 an hour. The city also has this living wage ordinance that applies to businesses that work with the city or do business with the city. And that's currently $21.06. So, you know, even that, I think, is still pretty far from what someone would need to earn to, you know, fully be able to support themselves.
Yeah, and I think even Scott earlier mentioned that living wage piece of it. And I think that there's some overlap here to what was passed, including like convention center workers, right, Scott? I mean, talk more about, you know, this cost of living issue here.
Yeah, well, this originated from the city council's new committee on addressing the cost of living. And I mean, there's a lot of people pointing out the irony that the city council itself is raising the cost of living in so many different ways with the fees and trash fee and other different things they're doing to close the budget. The city itself doesn't pay that high of a minimum wage. It's still at the regular minimum wage. I've talked to several city leaders who point out that, you know, union leaders of city employees say that's fine. I think that's probably part of the discussion here, that you might say, like, well, those workers are going to come back and wish that they made more. And I think that's part of the point. They want to see not just the workers at these entities directly affected see their compensation rise. They want to see the compounding effects, the managers that are supervising them get a bump. They want to see competitors, even the small hotels that were exempted, are going to have to compete with large hotels paying a better wage now. And I think, you know, city workers may very well come back to the city and say, like, okay, you passed this minimum wage. We'd like to see a bump or a way to get up to that rate as well. So there are not just the direct effects of the requirements, but then this compounding one. And I think that's what businesses were worried about when they were seeing it and go through as far as just adjusting to that in increasing costs. But you know what they'll point out is like the cost of living, you know, may go up. Going to SeaWorld may be more expensive. Going to Petco it's already very expensive, maybe even more. And so, you know, the money doesn't just come from nowhere. So we'll have to see now what the trade-off for it was.
Andrew, you know, we've touched on organized labor a little bit here. We'll talk more about their role here. But San Diego City Council member Sean Elo Rivera really pushed for the minimum wage increase along with local labor leaders. How has he characterized the state of the economy?
Well, Sean Elo Rivera has said many times in many different venues at the city council that San Diego has grown to become this really world-class tourist destination. We have multi-billion dollar corporations, you know, owning and operating these hotels like Hyatt and Marriott Bonvoy, and they make a lot of money here. And of course, you know, that tourism industry provides employment. It provides tax revenue that funds city services. But in Elo Rivera's opinion, local residents just haven't gotten a good deal in this bargain with these big corporations that are, you know, sort of the big players in the tourism industry. And you know, he said employees, especially in the tourism sector, have gotten a particularly bad deal. We have a clip from him. Let's hear what he said.
Corporate America has proven itself unwilling to share fairly with the workers who make their extravagant wealth possible. So, if forced to choose a winner, you're damn right I'm choosing the workers.
So, you know, some pretty strong wording there. Scott, you know, you talked a little bit about some of the arguments the hotel operators were making in the run-up to this. What is the state of local tourism right now, and how did that play a role in this debate?
I think that's, you know, I think honestly that might be what kept them from funding a referendum right now, is that there are bigger problems on the horizon. There are a lot of hotels are looking and are looking at the bookings for next year and the year after, and because of some of the national and international news and changes, there's a lot fewer people at least planning to come to San Diego. I think that there was a lot of people in these hotel and Padres and in these different interest groups that were remarking about how interesting it was that Bridget Browning, the executive secretary of the Labor Council, the Union of Unions, was, you know, basically their negotiating partner at City Hall, you know, had basically a seat at the table. And if they made various deals, then they could get the phase-ins and such. It was very clearly a very strong move by the Labor Council and by Bridget, and I think that it was also a kind of coming out for a new way of politics sort of being arranged in San Diego. So Sean Elo Rivera is obviously very progressive and has a very strong principles, but he's also quite open to talking to the businesses and said, look, I'm not going to buy the argument that your businesses are going to fail in this tourism, you know, hotspot. But if you want to talk about like some, you know, common sense things that we should do to make sure it doesn't really hurt you right now, or that we can accommodate different things you bring up, I'm going to listen. And by all accounts, he did that. And it was also the first major policy issue that Chris Cate, the new CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, was engaged with as the new chamber CEO. And he really pushed hard too to kind of strike a point that the businesses weren't going to go down too easy on this, and they sent out all kinds of text messages and campaign style things to try to adjust it. So it's interesting. I feel like the business community is starting to get more organized. After Trump first election, they really sort of fell in line almost with Democrats, or you know, you could almost see them with their skateboard over their shoulder saying, "Hey, fellow Democrats," but they're now starting to get their own independent kind of right of center voice and alignment going. And it'll be really interesting to see how that looks in coming years.
Andrew, Scott just mentioned Bridget Browning, local labor leader. You know, I want to throw it to you. What does this signal to you about the power of organized labor and its role in city politics today?
Well, I think it just is really striking how much influence unions have gained in recent years at City Hall. When I got here in San Diego in 2015, Democrats had a 5-4 majority on the city council, so enough to pass something, but not enough to override a veto from the mayor, who was a Republican, and the city attorney at the time was Republican as well. And now in 2025, it's kind of hard to imagine any Republican winning elected office in the city. We have 9 Democrats on the city council, a Democratic mayor and city attorney, and unions have played a role in that shift. They spend money in elections. You know, they are sympathetic to the Democrats who are sympathetic to their concerns. But I think that they've gained all of this influence, not just by spending money and electing their allies, but also by just making arguments that a lot of people find pretty convincing. The middle class used to be, I think, more insulated from San Diego's high cost of living than they are today. But as we've seen the gap between the uber rich and everybody else growing in recent years, not just in San Diego, but really across the country, I think that's part of what has made San Diego more sympathetic to unions that represent the lowest wage workers and, you know, also more democratic. And I do believe also, yeah, we have a clip from Bridget Browning, the head of the Hotel Workers Union Unite Here Local 30. Here's what she said.
I want to say that I am so proud of you all because you are standing up for invisible workers, because for many, many years, no one cared about our community. As long as they kept their heads down and cleaned the rooms and did what they were supposed to do, everybody was happy with that. But now times are changing. We have to reinvent the economy. You can be rich, but you don't have to be billionaires.
Scott, just jumping off, you know, what Andrew had to say, that clip from Bridget Browning there is, you know, illustrates his points. I mean, your thoughts on organized labor and how you've seen that shift over your time here.
Well, I'm a little older than Andrew, and yeah, when I started here, it was a very Republican city. In fact, I think that what was interesting is not only was it a very dominated political landscape by Republicans, but they were the professional political operators too, the restaurants, the business, the building industry. They all hired professional lobbyists and operators and campaign consultants. And that professional class is now Democratic. So either they left San Diego, the old Republican professionals, or they became Democrats. And, you know, the infrastructure fully flipped over to the Democratic side. And like I said, I think the, you know, the business community is starting for the first time, I think, since that really switched about 10 years ago to get their voice back and try to realign something. I think in a weird way, you know, they might have been happy that Trump won nationally, but it really set back, I think, their hopes that they could get back to a post or get to a post-Trump world where the Republicans compete again. But yes, labor unions have significant influence at San Diego City Hall, and now a majority influence at the county of San Diego. And you're seeing that play out in the choices they're making for leaders of the bureaucracies and the kind of arguments and priorities they're showing. And, you know, in the county of San Diego, they got into reserves, a goal they've been going for a long time, to tap into the vast reserves that the county has. And one of the first things those reserves will do is give the city or the county employees a bonus. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that that influence, you know, shows in outcomes. And so it is a different time in San Diego, and we'll see how far it goes.
Andrew, and we have about 30 seconds left, but, you know, Scott touched on this earlier. For workers more broadly, San Diego's minimum wage remains at that $17.25 an hour. What do you think this means for other workers in the city?
Well, we know the marketplace of labor is very interconnected. It is a marketplace. So, you know, if you are covered by this ordinance, you're going to get a raise. If you're not covered by this ordinance, then, you know, maybe those other jobs that do pay higher wages are more attractive to you and you know, are motivated to leave your current employer. So we could definitely see, I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this higher minimum wage in the hospitality sector impacts not just those that are directly covered by the ordinance, but you know, really the industry as a whole.
Well, appreciate you both being here and kind of breaking some of this down. I'm sure there'll be more conversations to be had here. I've been speaking with KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen, along with Voice of San Diego's Scott Lewis. Andrew, Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
When Roundtable returns, local news has seen significant declines over the past couple decades. How one local news outlet is expanding its coverage in San Diego. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. It's hard to put it any other way, but local news has been struggling. One study released earlier this year found a 75% drop in the total number of local journalists since 2002. Other research finds the number of local news outlets is shrinking, leaving some communities without coverage at all. But the Times of San Diego is one local news outlet that's expanding its coverage in new ways and with new incoming leadership as well. Chris Genowine is the founder and senior editor with Times of San Diego, and Andrew Keats is its newly minted general manager and editor. I want to welcome you both to Roundtable. Chris, can you tell us the original vision for Times of San Diego?
Sure, and it's great to be on the Roundtable today. I started Times of San Diego in 2014. I had just come off running Patch for Southern California, and that company was sold. And I reflected on what do I want to do in journalism? And what I wanted to do was create an online news site that would pick up where newspapers were leaving off, because they were laying off staff, they were putting in expensive paywalls, and that made it harder and harder for readers to get authoritative local information. I also wanted to, in this difficult media environment, try to create a model of sustainability, a model that could perhaps be used in other places to make sure that local news thrives. And after 11 years, it's great to be able to pass it on to Andy. It's really the next generation taking over this vision.
And Andy, I think you're just getting started there. I mean, how are you? How's it going so far?
Well, you know, a lot of a first week of any job is going to be a lot of onboarding meetings and Zoom phone calls and filling out paperwork. And so I have done more than my share of that for the last little while. But luckily here towards the back half of the week, I've been able to get my hands dirty and do some journalism.
And, you know, Chris, you've had a long career working in journalism, much of it here in San Diego. What did the local news landscape look when your career began here?
I started here in 2001, and interestingly, just a week before 9/11, the San Diego Union Tribune was the dominant newspaper. There was another very strong newspaper based in Escondido. I came in to run signonsandiego.com, which at the time was a money-losing newspaper website. what I focused on was making it sustainable, making it profitable, and increasing the news coverage. So it was doing primarily breaking news. You know, in that period of time, you know, we could always rely on the newspaper. We really can't do that anymore. And by I think it was 2008, the Copley family had already sold the newspaper. It's now gone through, I forget how many ownership changes. And it's really now incumbent on new startups, a new generation of publications to take the, you know, to run with the banner and provide local news here.
And Andy, you yourself, you know, no stranger to the world of San Diego journalism. You've produced award-winning work for places like Voice of San Diego, more recently, Axios San Diego. What did you learn from those experiences and you know, how it fits into an online news outlet that can be successful today?
Well, you know, I think every outlet in San Diego does something somewhat differently. The thing that has become clear to me over the last 15 years in local journalism is just how far we are. I mean, we are just light years away from anything that could be described as resembling like a full news environment. We're so far in the hole from where we were, even when I got here, which, by the way, when I got here, it's not like anyone thought we were living through the golden age of journalism, where there was more reporters and more stories than anybody could possibly want. It already felt like we had been diminished and broken down, and things were receding. And even from then till now, I could list, run off the names of three or four different publications that no longer exist. And so most of that work has not been replaced. And so while, you know, Voice of San Diego, where I worked for a long time, does incredible investigative reporting, and they have sort of run into the building while it was on fire and tried to put back together some of what was lost as in political coverage, in education coverage, in investigative resources, you know, they remain a publication that can focus on those things very well. Axios was an interesting publication that can do a lot of stuff that people like, and it produces a newsletter that can, I think, connect people to its audience. But, you know, I mean, both of those organizations together represent a tiny, tiny fraction of what's been lost in the journalistic world, even from 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, you know, like you cite the study, there was over like 40 reporters per 100,000 residents at the turn of the century. And we're now down, you know, around like 7 or 8 reporters per 100,000 residents. So Times of San Diego, we have a big job ahead of us. But even if we were wildly successful, we would be only scratching the surface of getting back to where, you know, what I think people would consider something like a healthy news environment.
Chris, your career in online journalism goes back a long ways, even before your time here. I think you mentioned, you know, Patch, which is one, you know, entity you were with for some time, but it goes back even further. Tell us more about, you know, your start bringing newspapers online and some of the challenges that came about with that.
Well, I began my career as a reporter and an editor at newspapers, but I was always intrigued with where technology might take this this media industry. Back in the mid-80s, Knight Ridder, which I later worked for, had a very well-funded experiment called Viewtron in South Florida. They spent $40 million on it. It required a special terminal. Never did pan out, but what happened was the technology kept getting less and less expensive. Soon there were personal computers, and then there were modems, and then there were internet connections. I started an early online site for the Atlanta newspapers, Access Atlanta. It's still there, accessatlanta.com, although it's now the entertainment vertical they have. Did the same thing in Silicon Valley at the San Jose Mercury News. And then after that came to San Diego. What I've always tried to do is innovate and try out new things. And I always thought that local news would ultimately prosper if we, you know, if we as journalists were flexible enough and kept changing and kept trying new ideas. And I think that's exactly what you're going to see with Times of San Diego over the next several years.
Chris, what holes do you see in local coverage in San Diego today?
Well, I think it's not San Diego. It's all over. It's if you go get a newspaper from, say, the 1940s or 50s, and you start flipping through it, it's amazing how much they covered. Articles were shorter, but there would be dozens of articles every day on everything from the women's club to a new subdivision going up to the latest statement by a local Congress member. And we've kind of gotten away from that. We focus on a few things every day, even at times in San Diego, although we cover a lot of stories, 20 to 30 on a typical day. There's a lot out there we still don't cover. So I see gradually building staffs up. I see gradually covering more and more. I think it's important to provide comprehensiveness and depth.
Andy, what stories, you know, what types of stories are you most interested in seeing more of?
Well, I think this is a big county, and right now I think a lot of the places that have lost coverage and a lot of the coverage that Chris is referring to there that, you know, decades ago were covered as a matter of course are in smaller cities or in specific communities within the city. You know, honestly, City Hall's covered fairly well. You know, Voice of San Diego does a great job covering City Hall. Union Tribune does a very good job covering City Hall. City News Service will reproduce stories you know, that come out of City Hall every day. There were more people covering City Hall 15 years ago than there are now, but the risk of something really gigantic happening at City Hall in plain sight on a given day and no one being around to see it is fairly small. That's not true in other city halls around the county, in Oceanside City Hall or in Vista City Hall, or, you know, God forbid, in every little school board around the county, all the water districts around the county. There's public meetings. There's all sorts of information happening all over the county that just outnumbers the amount of reporters around to write it up. Even if they had, you know, more time or more demands or more places to put it, there's just more stuff happening than there are reporters to cover it. And I do think that there is sort of a facade of more coverage in the county than there really is, because we have many more small sites that have popped up. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the mastheads around town, you would say, you know, San Diego's got a lot of news. You know, there's a lot of news happening in San Diego. You know, we've got different nonprofits and we've got different, you know, places like Axios San Diego, but all those places have so many fewer reporters than, you know, than the Union Tribune and the North County Times did a while ago. So the sort of number of titles, I think, obscures the loss of journalists, you know, actual reporters.
And on that, you know, emphasis on, you know, reporting more on specific communities, you mentioned just the size of the county, right? Mm-hmm. Earlier this year, Times of San Diego announced incorporating a stable of local community papers to its roster. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about papers, we're actually meaning these are still actually printed papers, right? Tell us more, you know, about some of those and your vision for those.
Yeah, so we've got the community newspaper group. There's you know, seven local community papers, Mission Times Courier, Peninsula Beacon, Beach and Bay Press, and this group of papers, they are still relied on by the community. They still provide community news that people, you know, people in those places pick up and read, and they learn about what's happening in their community. They, you know, they might be anything as small from a business open to a, you know, city council decision with a direct impact. So those are real papers, and we're really proud to have them. It's a big part of what we're going to do. The task ahead of us is to sort of combine the newsroom that Times of San Diego has built under Chris with the sort of disparate newsrooms that have been put together, those community papers, into one collective entity and to sort of be a force multiplier. So, you know, the way that those two things can work together is, I think a lot of, you know, information that may, decisions that may be happening at school boards or at city halls are playing out in a very specific way in these specific communities. And if we can cover those things in those communities and then reach up to what their broader significance is, as opposed to covering them from the you know, position of the city council or the school board as decisions that are trickling down to the community. So a grassroots up, as opposed to a sort of big picture down scenario. I think we might have an ability to make those decisions more real for people, and an opportunity to hear more voices in the community on a daily basis, and to react better to what people are worried about and what they say they want to know more about. And so if we, and then at the same time, we'll still have Times of San Diego. We'll still have reporters who are looking at the city from a big picture perspective. And so I think it's going to be a very symbiotic relationship, and we'll sort of be able to be better together.
Chris, go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry. I was going to just add one thing that it's amazing how much interesting local coverage that I frankly didn't know about. But when you have the content from seven newspapers going online, it really dramatically increases what we're covering.
I mean, Chris, earlier you mentioned this idea of news, you know, sustainability and the challenges that come with that. I mean, the economic realities for news are you know, pretty difficult. How feasible is it to provide local news sustainably?
I'm convinced that it's very possible, but it takes a new business model. Times of San Diego, at its two years ago, was analyzed by the Financial Times, and they considered us what they called an archetype of sustainability. We had found a way to cover a lot of news at very low cost using the wonderful internet environment that has developed. One of the challenges of newspapers has always been an extremely high cost structure. You've got presses, and even if you outsource printing is still 75% of your costs. And then a lot of traditional ways of managing, traditional ways of editing are just too expensive. You have large staffs, you have large overhead, you have bureaucracy. I think what we can do in the online space is become much more nimble and operate much more efficiently. With Times of San Diego now, we've gone from being a for-profit to a hybrid nonprofit. We're still selling advertising because for many readers, advertising is important additional information, but we're also taking donations and we're also taking philanthropic grants. And I think those things combined with very efficient operation will make it sustainable. And also we've got the backing of Newswell, which is a nonprofit affiliated with Arizona State University and the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Communication. They're now providing a lot of the back end support for what we're doing so that we, Andy and team, can focus on the journalism.
So Andy, you know, we've kind of covered some of the, you know, challenges with local journalism. How are you feeling about the future of local news in this, you know, your new role here?
Well, you know, I'm optimistic about it. I think the base reality of what's going on in the industry is unavoidable, and I don't take that lightly. But I'm optimistic about what we have in front of us as a plan. The association with Newswell and ASU is not a small thing. I imagine that sort of the business operations could be a less interesting topic than how we get out in the community and write more stories. But it's a real thing to be able to take HR and IT and finance costs off of our plate and have a newsroom that's just focusing on doing as much good journalism as possible. And I should add, you know, there's Newswell has its own investigative editor. It's got a California-wide managing editor, and we have a, you know, they've hired a immigration reporter who's, you know, technically a staffer for Newswell, but who will be based in our Times of San Diego office and will be, you know, doing, you know, immigration reporting here out of San Diego. So it really is creating a system that allows us to do more good journalism, you know, in the world where we have fewer resources than we'd like.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. We'll have to leave it there for now. I've been speaking with Chris Genuine and Andy Keats from Times of San Diego, and hope to talk to you again soon on some of your reporting. Andy, Chris, thanks so much.
Thank
Great
you.
Being here. Thank you.
Up ahead, We hear about a few other stories in our weekly roundup, including the latest one from a KPBS investigation into county-run animal shelters. Stay tuned. Roundtable's back after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. It's time now for our weekly roundup to catch up on some other stories. And I'm joined again by KPBS producer Ashley Rush. Hey, Ashley.
Hey, Andrew.
So what stories are at the top of your list this week?
Yeah, so this is a big story out of the KPBS investigative team, and it's a follow-up to some long-form reporting into euthanasia at San Diego County-run animal shelters by Scott Rodd and Elaine Alfaro. They found that the dog euthanasia rate at county-run shelters has more than doubled in recent years. Volunteers and former employees claimed that dogs in those shelters were regularly and unnecessarily put down due to mild behavioral issues, things like fearfulness, separation anxiety, and resource guarding. But the big news is that this week, Scott Rodd published another follow-up story to the piece, and KPBS obtained text messages from a top official in the Department of Animal Services. Her name is Rachel Borelli. And in a text thread that KPBS found, you know, she's discussing the county's euthanasia policies. And one of the voice messages sent in that thread was pretty disturbing, so brace yourself, we're going to play it now.
Yeah, but in Carlsbad, they don't euthanize anything, even if the dog bit a kid. So that's why I was like, euthanize the dog. Like, I'm so sick of us keeping dogs that aren't going to get adopted. That's why we're overcrowded.
Wow, it's pretty strong words. So, I mean, how did they respond to hearing about these comments?
Yeah, so Borelli, the person you just heard, declined to comment when KPBS reached her by phone. But a county spokesperson said they can't comment on specific personnel matters, but that the information provided doesn't reflect their values or their mission. And that statement went on to say that they're working on better policies and training to support their employees and animals in their care, but they did not specify which changes they plan to make. So check out that full story and all the stories that preceded it on our website, kpbs.org.
For the next story I have is around schools. And we had an education roundtable at the start of the school year where this topic kind of came up. But Jacob McWinney from Voice of San Diego reported last week on this plan announced to eliminate certain middle school grades at some K through 8 schools. These were a few schools in southeastern San Diego. And the idea was to kind of trim those top level grades at those schools and have them go into a, you know, specific dedicated middle school. These include Golden Hill, Fulton, Audubon, and Bethune. Those are the schools that the San Diego Unified announced they were going to make this change. But And the reasons for that, they cited lower performance. But in later reporting this week, Jacob wrote that the district is now reconsidering that move for Bethune. That was one of the local schools after, you know, considerable community pushback. Parents mobilized. They kind of went on the news, wrote letters, all sorts of stuff. One local parent just cited frustration with the lack of public input in this decision and said, told Jacob, quote, I have issues with the lack of input, lack of communication, lack of consideration. And it sounds like that community effort is sort of having an impact here, and San Diego Unified's, you know, looking into how to handle Bethune differently. KPBS's Katie Anastas also covered this, you know, kind of wrote about some of the reasons the district's looking to make this move, said, I guess those middle school grades have more, basically just like options, more electives they can choose, more services at those middle schools specifically. So it's an interesting topic and something that'll, you know, I'm sure we'll be following through the school year as it progresses. And now next, you have a story about some changes coming for recommendations around COVID vaccines, particularly here in California.
Yeah, so this next story is out of CalMatters, and it looks at new vaccine guidelines out of the West Coast Health Alliance. And if you haven't already heard about that, it's this newly formed alliance between California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii. And they're releasing their own recommendations for vaccines kind of in the face of all the turmoil at the CDC. Just a refresher on that, you'll remember that in June, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed all 17 members of a federal vaccine panel at the CDC, and then he replaced them with 12 new members, some who are documented vaccine skeptics. So this West Coast Health Alliance is, you know, now issuing their own recommendations for COVID, flu, and RSV vaccines.
So actually, one thing I know, sometimes it's hard to kind of find the information for all this stuff. So now this is a little change here. I was used to going to like CDC and all that stuff, but right. Now this is going to be a separate set of recommendations. Where can people go to find those?
Yeah, so it looks like you can find all those guidelines and updated information at cdph.ca.gov. That's the California Department of Public Health. And another thing to note, Governor Gavin Newsom also just signed this bill, Assembly Bill 144, which, among several things, would require insurance plans to cover the vaccines the state of California endorses. So there's some more information about that legislation as well on that website, cdph.ca.gov.
For this next story I had, just briefly wanted to talk about it. New York Times has been doing a series of stories on the health struggles facing wildfire firefighters. I mean, we know we're in wildfire season now. Governor Gavin Newsom named September Preparedness Month. And we know California will continue to face the challenges from wildfire. And firefighters are just, you know, the firefighters who battle them are essential to that. But many are working, you know, in really dangerous conditions, and a lot of them are inhaling toxic chemicals and without facial protection in a lot of cases. And I didn't realize this, but, you know, they go into these, you know, huge flames with toxic smoke without protection, and many are having health impacts from it. This most recent story in the New York Times from Hannah Dreyer tells the story of one wildfire firefighter who battled blazes in California, who now has an aggressive form of leukemia, and he found that out on the eve of his 25th birthday. So he's quite young. But, you know, he worked 24-hour shifts fighting these just massive fires and has gone into, you know, debt from the health struggles. Another thing about, you know, wildfire firefighting is a lot of cases it's not just national and state firefighters. It's a lot of private companies, and they may not have benefits and low wages. So it just really is an interesting look into the challenges these firefighters face, as the World Health Organization, you know, does say firefighting does cause cancer. So it's an interesting, some interesting reporting there from the New York Times. Okay, so we're at time here, but I just want to finish with a little bit of good news here. And this weekend, there's a lot of stuff happening around town. I just wanted to remind folks, the Adams Avenue Street Fair is this weekend. There's also in Oceanside, the Supergirl Surf Festival is back. It's been going for a few years. And Axios San Diego actually highlighted this. The Pacific Islander Festival is happening this week at Ski Beach. So we did a little thing on Midday Edition on local summer. Mm-hmm. Those are a couple examples of ways you can, you know, take advantage this weekend. So with that, I've been speaking with KPBS producer Ashley Rush. Ashley, thanks.
Thanks, Andrew.
That'll do it for our show this week. Thanks so much for listening to KPBS Roundtable. You can listen to the show anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon Fridays, again Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show, you can always email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producers this week were Brandon Trufa and Ben Redlosk. The show was produced by Ashley Rush and Juliana Domingo. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm your host, Andrew Bracken. Thanks again for listening and have a great weekend.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their healthcare to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.